Learning for Life at Gustavus is produced by J.J. Aiken and Matthew Dobosensky of the Gustavus Office of Marketing. Will Clark, Senior Communication Studies major and videographer at Gustavus, who also provides technical expertise to the podcast, and me, your host, Greg Castor. The views expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those of Gustavus Adolphus College. In the 2016 presidential election, Donald Trump received just 6% of the black vote, compared to 91% for Hillary Clinton. And this was nothing new. Since 1964, black voters have by varying percentages resoundingly rejected Republican presidential candidates. What explains this and why does it matter? These questions are arguably more urgent than ever in an election year where one candidate, the incumbent president, has built his political brand and his presidency on appeals to whiteness, appeals that have become even more frequent and explicit in response to the massive protests against the police killings of black women and men that have arisen across the United States the past several months. All of this is why I'm excited to be speaking today with historian Tim Thurber of Virginia Commonwealth University, whose terrific 2013 book, Republicans and Race, the GOP's Frayed Relationship with African Americans, 1945-74, I think is essential reading for anyone trying to make sense of the racial politics of the 2020 presidential election. Tim, I am delighted to say, majored in history at Gustavus, graduated in 1989, and going on to earn his PhD in U.S. history at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's an expert in the history of party politics and civil rights since World War II. At Virginia Commonwealth, he teaches both undergraduate and graduate courses in 20th century U.S. history, while also maintaining an active research agenda. In addition to the aforementioned book and various articles and book chapters, he's also the author of an outstanding 1998 book titled The Politics of Equality, Hubert H. Humphrey and the African American Freedom Struggle, 1945-78. He's precisely why I wanted to speak with him for some useful and, as you will hear, in some ways surprising historical perspective on the Republican Party and this election, presidential election that's approaching. So welcome, Tim. I'm so thrilled, delighted we could reconnect for this. It's been a while.
Thank you, Greg. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thanks so much. Let's start where I like to do. You're a historian too. We're interested in origins, causes. So what led you to Gustavus? And where you grew up in Minnesota, if I'm remembering correctly.
I did, yes. Yeah. I grew up in the Twin Cities. And when it came time to look for a college, I was interested in getting away from home a bit, but not too far. So Gustavus fit that profile. And I'm Swedish in my own background, family history. And so there was that tie. And finally, I was very interested in a small college with small class sizes and lots of emphasis on good teaching.
And did you already know you wanted to be a history major, or was that something that came only in the course of your classes at Gustavus?
No, I'm not sure anybody shows up wanting to be a history major. Very few people anyway. I was interested in economics and remain interested in economic history and business, but was at first interested in pursuing something in economics. I also thought a bit about political science. I developed interest in politics in high school. But in the course of fulfilling distribution requirements and such, I had the good fortune to take American history, and one class led to another. And by my sophomore year or so, I had begun to think about teaching and wanting to study more history. And I still enjoyed economics, but my interest was moving in other directions.
And I remember, I think Kate and I, my wife Kate, who taught there as well, now retired, we met you probably, we came in 86, so that's when we would have met you. And I guess that was that your sophomore year, maybe? Something like that.
Sophomore, yeah. I started in the fall of 85, and yeah. I believe it or not, do remember you coming in to give a guest lecture in Kevin Burns' U.S. History Survey class. Yes.
Well, yeah, I was gonna say, let's do a shout out to Kevin, who was chair of the department when Kate and I were hired, and who really was your mentor at Gustavus. Mm-hmm. And I have such a strong memory. I don't know if it was your junior year or senior year of you doing the you got a National Endowment for the Humanities Younger Scholars Fellowship to work with Kevin. I don't think they have that program anymore, unfortunately. But you did a wonderful paper on Robert Kennedy, right?
Yes.
which I don't know, was that, you think that was the basis for your future work?
In some ways, it was an outgrowth of where interests were already headed. And then, you know, that I think continued some momentum that was already there. You know, it wasn't that long after finishing that project that I graduated, and then immediately upon graduation, entered graduate school. You know, I was, again, eager to continue studying history. So I went straight away.
And you worked at UNC Chapel Hill. You worked with the great Bill Luchtenberg. And is he still with us? I can't remember if he's passed.
Oh, no, he's still very much alive and writing. I haven't been in touch with him in a while, but he was always somebody in remarkable health, both physical and mental health, and, you know, continued to write books and be engaged intellectually after officially retiring from the university. So he has had a long and prolific career.
Tell us a little bit about what your dissertation work was like, your research at Chapel Hill.
Yeah, that was a continuation of, again, a merging of an interest in American politics, recent politics. You know, my interest in more recent political history of the 20th century grew out of an interest in current events, right? So to search for the roots of current events. While at Gustavus in various history classes, I developed an interest in the civil rights movement. And so those two streams of interest merged when I was looking for a dissertation topic, which led me to the study of Hubert Humphrey.
And that became the basis of your first book, I guess, your dissertation.
Yes.
Yeah. And we'll get to that in a bit. Let's dive into the more recent book, which I just think is outstanding, and I wish everyone should read it. The argument in there is really interesting. I mean, first of all, you point out there are sort of two dominant narratives about the Republican Party and race. Maybe we could start there. Just tell us what those are, because you're arguing against and revising those in the book.
Yeah, so you try to turn some of the conventional wisdom on its head, right? One, I guess the strongest one that resonated with me was the idea that somehow the party of Lincoln in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, somewhere up until the mid 60s, then did a sudden reversal. In many ways, when I began to dig into the history of the 1940s and 50s in particular, the book begins at the end of World War II. Simply put, I just didn't find much evidence for that. It was not so much often a case of hostility, although there was plenty of disagreement, particularly on economic questions about the role of government and trying to regulate business. Going along with that was just a disinterest, right? Republican lawmakers in Congress tended to come from rural areas, didn't have that much direct contact or experience with urban racial politics. The African-American population heavily urbanized. Again, we're talking about geographic focus as well in the Northeast and the Midwest,
right?
Where most Republicans at that time came from, right? In the 1940s and 50s, there were only a handful of Republicans from the South in Congress. One sees, just a prioritizing, I think, of other matters. I mean, there's from time to time issues do come to the fore, yes, but I look for evidence of engagement, right, with civil rights issues, right? I mean, the stereotype of a party of Lincoln would suggest a real, at least somewhat strong commitment to certain principles. And I just found the evidence thin for much of that early period. But then the historical context shifts, right? Again, it builds over time from the 40s through the 50s, and certainly by the rise of mass direct action protests in the 1960s and other events. Issues, as they always do in politics, right, come to the fore. That's not under anyone's direct control. That's history unfolding. In that different historical context, different situations emerge. And what I found, at least through the early 1970s, was a history of policy momentum. And I think, again, when one looks across at other areas of the history of public policy, a sort of a broad generalization holds true, and that is various policies of government acquire a momentum that for various reasons is hard to reverse. And so what I found when I looked at, particularly in Congress, we often have a presidential focus, but the book does, of course, focus on Dwight Eisenhower and Richard Nixon. But I was also very interested in Congress, which tends to get underplayed as an institutional force in our politics and in our policy analysis. And what I found in Congress, in particular, by the late 60s and early 70s, was an alliance of liberal Democrats and a handful of Republicans who, in effect, voted to sustain the policy initiatives. The best example that comes to mind right now would be the Voting Rights Act. The Voting Rights Act comes up for renewal in 1970, and there are conservative voices who cut across party lines, conservative Southerners ally with conservative Republicans looking to modify, basically weaken crucial aspects of the Voting Rights Act. But to make a long story short, they are defeated in Congress, and the Voting Rights Act, the core provisions that civil rights groups wanted, were renewed intact. And so, again, there's a history of momentum that is at play there. And so I found, in some respects, a relatively moderate, relatively even liberal, if we could use that term, and I think it fits in some cases, group of Republican lawmakers who were committed to these policy choices and were crucial in upholding the Voting Rights Act, again, in ways that organizations like the NAACP and others at the time wanted. And again, even to bring it back to presidents for just a second, even, again, Richard Nixon signed it. His motivations are complex, but he was under pressure from conservative advisors in his own administration saying, this is not our issue. We're not going to get any votes out of it. And even Nixon conceded in one of his letters saying, I know there's no votes in it for us, but I'm going to sign it anyway, he said. So he was a reluctant reformer in many ways, but again, he could have vetoed it, right? I mean, he talked about contingency and, at that moment, right, the president, whoever it is, has a choice to make. What would have happened had he vetoed it? I don't know. But he signed it, right? That's the point. And so, again, for various motives, but also I think, again, part of the larger point is building a policy apparatus that, at least through the early 1970s, had acquired some momentum within the party.
I love, there are many things I love about your book, but I love the focus on Congress, which is distinctive, different, I think, and important and revealing, illuminating, as you're suggesting. One thinks of Nixon. For me, so much of what when I think of the Republican Party, I think of it backwards from 68, right? And so I just assumed, the party's always been the party of, whiteness and reaction. But as you show so well, that's not the case. Were these Republicans acting, perhaps not Nixon, but were they acting out of principle primarily? I mean, what's your sense of what's motivating these Republicans in Congress to support these policies?
I do think a good bit of it was principle, right? That as they thought about the nation and where it stood in the late 60s and early 1970s, certainly Cold War pressures are an issue for some. Electoral pressures never go away, but I think to reduce it to electoral politics is to oversimplify it, right? I'm thinking of figures here like Robert Packwood in Oregon voting for it, Mark Hatfield, Jacob Javits in New York. These individuals had been in the Senate for quite a while and had been reelected, but as you mentioned earlier in the introduction, right? They never got black votes, right? In New York, right? The African-American vote is overwhelmingly Democratic. So here, if you're running as a Republican senator like Jacob Javits was, he's not faring much better than most Republicans were when it comes to the share of the African-American vote. And so, in many ways, Javits was a pretty liberal figure, and conservatives right. within his own party tried to, you know, paint him that way. And again, he was defeated by a conservative, Al D'Amato, right?
Al D'Amato, right?
You know, so the attack comes from the right, and so I see again, a number of other scholars have made similar arguments here, right? That something shifts in the Republican Party, particularly in the 1970s. On not just racial politics, but a number of other issues as well, like economics and the welfare state and a number of other things. Relatively moderate voices, they're gone.
They're gone
by the time Reagan appears in 1980.
Do you think, before we get to Nixon, let's start with Ike. Let's start with Eisenhower. What did you find I always think of him as sort of, he's portrayed as this reluctant, very reluctant on the civil rights front. Did you find that to be the case as you, I think you have at least one or two chapters about him in the book.
Yes. And I think that point more or less holds true. Yes. I mean, Eisenhower, I believe, was reluctant to push for federal answers to racial matters. Again, for a while, it's not a priority, right? He's president, he's got his eye on, I think, other issues, but then something like the Little Rock crisis, of course, becomes something it's impossible to ignore. But we forget one of the, I think more interesting things to me, at least when I was researching the book, was, again, historical memory becomes, what's the word I'm looking for? We have a way of telescoping things and maybe remembering things in a way that people at the time didn't experience. So the example I'm thinking about here is the Montgomery bus boycott. Something now every grade school kid, at least has heard of Rosa Parks, right? At the time, not that many people outside of the immediate civil rights community. I mean, the New York Times, if I remember right, put the Montgomery bus boycott way back in the paper. Eisenhower's attorney general said, "Well, we were kind of watching it, but we didn't think it was that big of a deal." And maybe that's worthy of criticism, but nevertheless, it stuff that we remember about history, we often stitch together narratives looking backward. Yes. Rather than going from point A to point B to point C to point D, and I think that's one of the values of history is that we can see things differently when we try to immerse ourselves in that world. I found Eisenhower reluctant in some respects, but in other respects, in areas of clear federal authority, he acted forthrightly. He desegregated military bases, schools, and other institutions in Washington, D.C., and so forth. So it's a mixed record, yes, nevertheless, one that did a few things. But on questions of voting rights and other things, again, very reluctant to use federal authority, and that would come.
I wonder if he would have signed the. Did he have to reassign the reauthorization to that? No, it hadn't been passed yet.
The 1957 Civil Rights Act. He did move on. That. Yeah, that was the first civil rights law passed by the federal government in 82 years or so, and
Rights Act of 65.
And then 8 years later, the Civil Rights Act in 1957, fairly toothless in terms of oversight on voting in particular, and that again helps bring further attention to the voting injustices in the South. And so then, again, momentum would build up over time. But, it would take 8 years. It's a long time, right, before we finally get the Voting Rights Act in 1964.
Right. The a couple of things you said, music to my ears as a historian and teacher of history. One, the role of contingency. I mean, what if, I interviewed Jim McPherson, the great Civil War historian, Gustavus Alum, and I learned so much about the role of contingency reading him, and I've incorporated that much more into my teaching than ever before. It's one of what I call the seven C's of history, contingency. And then the other thing is you're so right about, you use the Rosa Parks example where something from the past that looms so large in our present, may not have loomed that large in the minds of most people at the time. And it's funny you mentioned her because I had a first-term seminar years ago in the 1960s. I had a student, I was trying to have a student do some research on how The Northern Press covered the Montgomery bus boycott, and she was having trouble finding stuff. And I thought, oh, come on. But, you know, you're right about the New York Times. I was really surprised by that. You know, I thought it would be front page story. It was not.
No, it's just like so many things. Our consciousness shifts as events unfold. And then, you know, we can't go back to the old consciousness, right? But in certain respects, but that's life. That's how things develop over time. But yeah, I think it's a useful reminder that, you know, things that we in the present deem important or significant, people in the past didn't see the world in the same way we do.
Exactly. And that's part of the magic and power, I think, of historical research, where you uncover that. What about Nixon? I mean, you know, I teach the course on 68, and, you know, right away, the Southern strategy, right, thinking about Nixon and race and Wallace and race. What's the case for Nixon and civil rights beyond that he signs the reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act?
Yeah, such a puzzling figure, right? But that's what everybody says about Nixon. And oddly enough, I'm working on a little project on Nixon right now. Long story. It's going to be a book for classroom use, very short, a synthesis of existing work. It's not archival based, but I've spent the last year or so reading quite a lot about Richard Nixon.
You're the person I need to talk about.
So you want about Nixon, he's always fascinating, right? Never dull to read his memos or his scribblings on what his aides are sending him. I'm persuaded in many ways by what University of Michigan historian Matt Lassiter argues, right, that in many respects, Nixon was articulating a suburban strategy. It's Southern in part, yes. But I see it as heavily emphasizing suburban homeowners across the nation more so than white Southerners. In regards to policy, again, there's some surprising turns. One sees, you know, the emergence of affirmative action in the federal government, and then eventually enforcing contractors across the nation, right? Big corporations. And here too, again, the history of policy momentum. I mentioned the Voting Rights Act, but the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission was strengthened in the early 1970s, right? It was given additional enforcement powers, not in exactly the way that civil rights organization had hoped, but there was not a rollback. Again, conservatives in both parties were eager to get the federal government, you know, as they might say, off the backs of business when it came to regulating labor practices for non-whites, but also for women. There is, with the extension, I believe the year is 1972 when the EOC was strengthened. New categories of employees are brought under federal oversight. Again, the numbers escape me at the moment, but we're talking about hundreds of thousands, if not more, you know, employees, including, I believe, at universities, brought under federal labor protection. Against job discrimination, including, again, it's racial in part, but it's also applying to women. So it's a vast expansion of federal power. And again, there were vigorous debates. Civil rights groups wanted even stronger enforcement. So it's a kind of a compromise. It's hardly a rollback, right? It's not a rollback at all. Again, why does that happen? It happens in part because of coalitions forming in Congress, but also, again, Nixon signed it. Those provisions are still with us.
Yeah, and I think your point, which comes through so clearly in the book, it's not a rollback, is important. I mean, I confess, I've approached Nixon. It's a rollback, you know. Yeah. Reading your book has helped me to think anew about all of that.
Well, yeah, it's both and, right?
It's mixed, right?
It's mixed, very much so. Yeah. I mean, I'm not a Nixon apologist by any means.
No. Right.
But you know, again, at the same time, right? I just cite one other thing, right? There is greater school desegregation in the South under Nixon. And again, Nixon doesn't deserve, right. He doesn't play the major role in this. Other things are at work. No president's, in control of all things. But nevertheless, I do think there's a role that Nixon played there. But on the other hand, right, with his rhetoric, sometimes his actions, right? I mean, in the early 1970s, the federal government did go to court to try to slow down school desegregation. There's a lot of animosity between the Nixon administration and the NAACP and other prominent civil rights organizations. Black Americans, in terms of their opinions and voting patterns, don't see Richard Nixon as an ally in many respects, right? He's on stage with figures like Strom Thurmond and, right. That and more. So again, it cuts a number of different ways. But again, I think that's one of the points about studying history, right? History is often ambiguous. History exactly. is, can teach us something about ambiguity. And
you've been particularly, you've been particularly drawn to that, I think, and good mm-hmm. at that, because wasn't your, this takes us back to your undergraduate years, your paper on, RFK was really about that, if I'm remembering correctly. Mm-hmm. Was he a principled guy or am I right? Am I remembering?
Yeah, that's most on the right track. Yeah.
I think that's that complexity and that ambiguity is important. I'm teaching the our methods course right now, and there's a whole section on the reading for tomorrow about ambiguity, and I'm trying to do my best to get the students comfortable with that.
I try to emphasize that in all my classes. It's a hard message, I think, in many ways to get across. But I feel more strongly than ever, after years of teaching and reflecting on lots of different things personally and professionally, that an appreciation for complexity and ambiguity is central to so many things, not just our teaching but also in our personal lives and just life in general.
Exactly. I try to tell my students, history it's not the same as melodrama, evil villains and all good, it's not that simple, right?
Right.
If only it'd be a lot easier to teach. What has happened to the Republican Party? I mean, let's imagine you were writing an epilogue to the book today. Is it fair to say the party has basically abandoned the black vote for good reason? I mean, is there any hope that they would ever become a party engaged with black voters the way the party once was?
Good question. We'll see. I find the 2020 election to be interesting in so many ways, but this is one of many issues I'm interested in seeing how things turn out. I mean, everything here, again, is relative. They start from such a small base. In polls, I don't read that many polls, and I take them with a grain of salt, but... Sure. Just the few that I've seen, suggest that, is there something happening that, Trump could get to 15% or even approach 20%? That would be a pretty sizable jump in many ways.
What's the largest in 64 is 15%, if I remember?
64, it just falls off a cliff in 64 and never recovers, and it bounces between 10 or so and 15 and then down, as you say, into single digits. It starts from almost nothing. We'll have to see what happens this year. But I think at some level they're say what you want about politicians. I think most of them can count sort of who's on our team and who's on the other team, and in many ways act accordingly. I think that some of it, I think an underappreciated story in terms of politics, in terms of African-American voting, is, again, particularly since the 60s and 70s, I think a lot of the Republican Party's animosity and vice versa is rooted in, cuts to government, right?
Yes.
That since the 1970s, employment in the public sector has been very strong for African Americans, right? In education, policing, the federal government, a number of other areas.
Helped to create a black middle class, really.
Black middle class. And again, you can tie that back in some ways, again, to affirmative action hiring practices and other things, certainly. It was a tool to the middle class, a stepping Stone to the middle class. And again, the turn in rhetoric, but also in policy, right, at the federal level, but also at the state and local level, right? Let's not forget that too, right? It's, right. It's not all about the president in Washington. It's at, is what's happened in the states, right, is a lot of cuts and a lot of, you know, rhetoric directed against the public sector coming from the Republican Party. And I believe that's also a big factor.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think talked with some other historians, my colleagues, about that. Yeah, that you know, well, you even say this in your book at some point, that behind, to understand the racial politics of the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, we're really talking about two different views of government and of society, and that, you know, cuts to the public sector are, you know, they're racialized inevitably, right? Because so many African-American people are affected by that. As you say, not just at the federal level, but state and local as well. The I've been struck, too, this isn't obviously original, but the way Trump's rhetoric, sometimes crudely so, I'd say, echoes Nixon's. Have you been struck by that as well?
Yes. Yeah.
Or even Wallace's, I suppose. Wallace's maybe more than Nixon's.
I think one can make some links there. Absolutely.
You know, the suburban, you mentioned this Nixon sort of the suburban strategy, Southern strategy, but also suburban strategy. I mean, certainly Trump seems to be trying to play that card as well. What about Humphrey's role? I want to talk a little bit about that. I find Humphrey a fascinating figure. I've grown to be more interested in him since teaching the 68 course. I don't know if you know this book by Michael Cohen. He's a journalist for, not that Michael Cohen, but a journalist for The Globe, who wrote a book on the 68 election. And wow, I mean, it's funny. My respect for Humphrey both has increased as a result of reading that book and in a way decreased with respect to his stances on Vietnam, how long it seemed to take him to come around, you know. But talk to us a little bit about Humphrey and civil rights. We're here in Minnesota. You're from Minnesota. It's a subject dear to Minnesotans' hearts. What were your findings in that book? What was your thesis in that book?
Well, in part, I was interested in two broad areas. One is the again, the questions of voting and battles against legal segregation, but also economics, right? The whole civil rights struggle, and Humphrey didn't create this. This was, you know, in the movement from the beginning, right? That racial equality, racial justice demanded, you know, fighting on many different fronts, as it still does. So we have sort of lots of balls in the air at the same time, so to speak, right? Questions about participation in the political process, questions about desegregation of public institutions, public places, public accommodations, and as well as schools. And then the question, again, back to jobs and economic opportunity or the lack thereof, questions of poverty. And so in the book, I was trying to bring together Humphrey's engagement with all of these things, and found, particularly towards the end of his life, right, in a post-1960s environment, he was engaging and wrestling with questions that are still very much with us. And again, I've sensed this in the 90s as well, right? The politics, the framework was still very much with us then, as I think it remains with us now, right? Questions of, you know, how do you build coalitions? Can you build coalitions across racial lines, across class lines? Right? What options in a post-1968 context does the Democratic Party have in terms of which way it goes on questions of the role of the state and economic affairs and ongoing, again, efforts to preserve what had already been achieved in the 1960s. So all these things struck me as particularly interesting, again, with Humphrey in the last couple chapters or so of the book, wrestling with the economic crisis of the 1970s, which hit lots of Americans hard. And so, an attempt to build a universalist political coalition and the difficulties in doing that, the hazards, the challenges, as his career wound down. And so, the engagement with those issues, particularly drew my interest. And then, you know, in the earlier period, you know, again, when I circle back to what we were talking about earlier, you know, I did find Humphrey, of course, as, you know, the stereotype or popular image holds, right, out there as one of a handful of voices. Again, I just didn't find that many politicians in either party, you know, as I looked at the 1940s and 50s, all that interested in racial justice, racial matters. But Humphrey was there. And so that part of it, I think, is largely upheld. Right? I mean, like any politician, he trimmed and you know, sought accommodation. That's part of the game of politics. But relatively speaking, you know, was there literally showing up, right? Ways that other politicians, again, in both parties, plenty of Democrats, I would argue, in the 50s didn't pay much attention. I mean, Adlai Stevenson, John F. Kennedy, no.
Right.
There.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And what you said about Humphrey and economics, I mean, that I think it's there in your book. It's very powerful. And, you know, it's exactly where we're at today, right? The economic dimensions of race or racism and civil rights. He was on it. I mean, really, I think from the start, right? I mean, very early. What about, you come back to his efforts to build pluralistic coalitions. What's your assessment of it? How successful was he in that endeavor? What were the major impediments?
I think the major impediments were, again, a larger cultural and political moment in the 70s that was utterly disengaged. Well, not disengaged. I would say rather cynical or pessimistic about the role of government. I mean, make a long story short here. I mean, Humphrey, again, the ardent New Dealer, right? Franklin Roosevelt was his hero.
Right.
And so, you know, as Humphrey looked at the economic crisis of the 70s with unemployment mounting, again, high rates of poverty in particular parts of the country, Humphrey literally went back to the 1930s and saw the New Deal as a blueprint to say, let's in effect dust this off. How are we going to deal with a society where more and more people are, you know, again, unemployment's rising in the 1970s. You know, it's much higher for African Americans than for whites, but it's rising for whites too. And the model is for a while to say let's craft a policy that would have the federal government be again as it was in the Great Depression, an employer of last resort. And again, rooted in many of the same arguments, right? That the New Deal was, right? That idleness was corrosive to the human spirit, that people would find common ground, Humphrey hoped. Faced resistance, not just from across the aisle, but also within the Democratic Party, right? I mean, by this time, Jimmy Carter is ascendant, and Jimmy Carter is not a New Dealer, to put it succinctly. there's a larger pessimism, I think, and again, that's still very much with us, obviously, right, about the idea that government could be a force for good. I mean, Humphrey remained committed to that throughout his life. And again, he learned that from the New Deal, for all of its imperfections, right? The basic landing point for Humphrey was that, you know, government can improve people's lives. He saw that in his own family, his own communities, growing up, and remained committed to that broad principle throughout his life, and tried to apply it in the 1970s. But in the wake of the 60s and the 70s, the national mood wasn't there, so the effort fizzled.
Yeah, I think it's so true, his sense of the role government could play. I mean, just listening to you describe it, it seems quaint in the current moment almost.
Oh, sure does.
Yeah. What about, you know, I'm curious when you, I mean, you weren't quite writing a biography, I realize, but still, when you're working on a book like that, how did you feel over time about Humphrey? I mean, did you find yourself changing your view of him, or admire him more or less, mixed? Your relationship to the subject.
Sure, good question. Now, one thing that stood out was, broadly speaking, a greater empathy or sympathy, or certainly, you know, again, a revised view. I found Humphrey to be a sharper thinker than I think he's sometimes given credit for, right? Particularly in 1968, he felt this very personally, that a lot of folks on the East Coast in particular, who had been used to working, you know, in government, even though he'd been in government a long time, they kind of thought he was this sort of corny Midwesterner. And I can understand where that comes from a bit, but in reading his speeches and looking more closely at him, you know, I found a somewhat greater intellectual depth. You know, you can agree or disagree with his answers to policy solutions, right? But, you know, the idea that, you know, that there's more there in terms of intellectual heft, I think, than maybe some of his critics, again, from the left, were inclined to acknowledge.
Yeah, that's very interesting, especially think about Johnson himself sort of feeling that, you know, the East, quote unquote, Eastern elite seeing him as some kind of backwater Texas hick.
Yeah.
And you got Humphrey with the you know, he's from flyover country.
Right.
As we would say. Yeah, I agree with that assessment actually, just based on this this book I've read. I was impressed with some of those, the policy memos he would send to Johnson, particularly one about Vietnam. And I think that well, you know much more than I do.
Well, you know, labor too, right? I mean,
yeah,
Humphrey comes out of the labor movement and, retained strong labor support, compared to McGovern and some of the other prominent figures by the 1970s in the Democratic Party. And so there too, again, a seriousness of engagement with some big questions that I think belies some of the stereotypes.
Yeah, good points. What about your research for both books? I mean, it's taken you into talk a little bit about that, if you would. The arc. I mean, they're both massively researched, Tim. I mean, my God, I mean, it's so impressive. Yeah. In fact, with the most recent book, I just was thumbing through the notes just for fun. I mean, incredible. But tell us a little bit about that research process, if you would.
Sure. As you say, it involved a massive amount of travel, right? I can't even remember all the states at the moment, right? Just as far west as California to Georgia, Florida, Texas, and, you know, Abilene, Kansas for Dwight Eisenhower, New York. And so, yeah, I hit a lot of different parts of the country, spent a lot of time in archives and on the road for that book. And, you know, it's an exciting process of discovery, right? It's one of the things I like about doing history, right? It's a bit like detective work, right? And there's a lot of tediousness to it, right? You're sifting through just form letters and, you know, stuff that's pretty meaningless. But then every once in a while, you hit something, right? And sort of the light bulb moment, like, aha, this is really fascinating, right? And there's just an innate pleasure in sort of piecing that stuff together that comes from the research process. I found that to be sustaining, because again, it took a long time to do that book, it was rewarding in the end in many ways. I also enjoyed, again, thanks to technology, right, was able to go online and read, I can't even remember how many years worth of Jet magazine, right?
All
digitized, right?
All there,
and it was fascinating to read Jet magazine, right? As a window into one aspect. Obviously, Jet doesn't speak for all Black America. Nobody does, but it was a window. And I, didn't find many historians using it, but they, Jet was very much engaged with politics. And so I found, stuff there that was just really, really wonderful and illuminating, but it only came as a result of doing the work of looking. It was literally quick scan. Word searches weren't enough, right? So sometimes right now you can do keyword searches and find and zero things,
yes.
But I didn't find that to be helpful. At least in the case of Jet at the time. Now maybe things are different now, but at the time I felt like I had to scroll through every issue because there was never, there's always going to be some kind of surprise, a moment of unexpected delight, yes. Even where aha, I never would have found that if I hadn't literally been moving sequentially through the pages and through that. But of course it's very time intensive.
Yeah, as you say, it's research. You said it so well. It's both tedious and a pleasure. I agree. And, you know, to invoke a cliche here, it's a marathon, not a sprint. And I found sometimes in teaching research to undergraduates, it's hard to get that across, right? The time commitment that it takes, the willingness to scroll through things, and maybe for 6 hours nothing comes up, but then there's that moment, as you say, where I found it. Mm-hmm. And keyword searches, absolutely, they don't always reveal what you're looking for. I've been doing some the student new wasn't a newspaper but a publication back in 1918 at Gustavus, digitized now through the archives, and I was just curious what was going around influenza. Mm. And I was doing the keyword search, pandemic, influenza. I couldn't really find anything. And then finally, I just started scrolling, right? And I would find, some interesting things. One of the things that's interesting is how normal things seem to be at that time, by the way. I mean, the longest article I could find about influenza in the student publication was a lament about what it had done and U.S. Army regulations, what it had done to the football season.
Some things never change.
Exactly right. Yeah. But also just the fun, just the pleasure of scrolling through, right? It's how we go back in time. Anyway, I'm off on a tangent here. Mm-hmm. But the what about the congressional sources? What were you using there?
And same thing, the congressional record. I found, stuff in the congressional record, but you really had to dig for it, right? All kinds of crazy stuff gets inserted into the congressional record, but when you go looking, you find, this is relevant to what I'm looking for, right? So I found all sorts of juicy little nuggets that I found very revealing, again, about policy and political matters, that the only way to get it was to, open it up and sift through it, right? You obviously use the index as your starting point, but then, once you get back into a debate, you just sort of plow through it. I mean, I'm not reading every word, of course, in the congressional record, but I would look for, stuff that newspaper articles, for example, right? Members of Congress like to insert newspaper stories. Well, I wouldn't have found that newspaper story because I never would have looked at that, publication on my own, but there it is right in front of me in the congressional record. And then all of a sudden that opens up some important avenues and interesting insights that, again, wouldn't have come to me had I not looked there. And so
that's kind of neat. The congressional record as its own archive in a way.
That's right.
Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah.
In the time remaining, I want to step back a bit and kind of hear what you have to say about history. Right. Mm-hmm. We both know how, it's been a tough sell last number of years. What's your pitch for the study of history?
Yeah, great question. I try to make it to students, and I absolutely agree. It's a tough sell. Maybe it always has been, but I do think there are some things in our recent past that are making it a harder sell. But what I try to say to students is, there's a few things. One is that on a very personal level, I do believe history enriches our lives. It gives our lives some depth and flavor that they wouldn't have. Everything that you could possibly be interested in, this is one of the things that attracted me to history, right? Everything that you could possibly be interested in has a history. Sports, business, politics, art, music, right? Food, all of it. There's a history to it. And if you approach those things in your life without an awareness of the past, you might still enjoy them. But I argue, can't quantify it. It's just a feeling, right? But I believe it's real, that your experience of those things and hence your life and the lives of those around you will take on a greater depth. And that's no small thing, I think. You will have a more meaningful, richer experience, again, in your career, your family, your community, being a citizen, whatever, if you know something about the past. The other thing I would circle back to again is that point we raised earlier about complexity and ambiguity. I think that's so important. Maybe this has been true of human beings for just about forever, but we tend to oversimplify things. very distrustful of ideologues of all sorts. And I think that comes in part from history.
Yes.
That the world's a lot more complex. We still have to make choices. We still have to act. Right? But nevertheless, I think history can help us see things as more complex than many others might want to portray them. And in that sense might guide us, I hope. I think it's far from guaranteed. Right. But I would hope that it would guide us towards, again, some better decision-making, right? That the world didn't just begin this morning. It's not just what happened in the last 15 seconds on Twitter. And so what happened yesterday or last year or 100 years ago or maybe even further back than that, right? Shapes what we do now. It may close off certain paths or make them narrower or may open up other things. But we are shaped by and can use history as we make hopefully some better decisions about where we might go in the future. The other thing, a couple of things that have struck me in again, particularly in the pandemic, but even before the current crisis, I find myself, but I also try to tell students, one of the things I take from history is I'm very skeptical whenever I hear people trying to predict the future, right? I mean, we see this in the media all the time about this is changing forever and this is, never going back there or this is what's going to happen. And, maybe that's endemic to human psychology. Maybe it's a control mechanism of some sort. We could psychologize it, I suppose. But just from a historical standpoint, one of the things that comes through to me is how many, so-called smart people in the past got the future very wrong. Exactly. They were either too optimistic and things turned out much worse than they had hoped, or maybe sometimes they're too pessimistic. And you know what? Maybe the future is not so bleak. I think we tend to catastrophize things right now. And again, I think there's something about our own time with social media and the constant bombardment of information that I think exacerbates this. I think it's always been there perhaps, but I think it's more pronounced given the media climate we're in. But I tend to say, let's hold off a second here, right? I'm not so sure it's going to turn out that way, right? Let's keep open that back to that point about contingency and let's just see where this goes. Again, we have to make decisions based on the best information we can at the time. But I particularly find a lot of pessimism right now, and I understand where that comes from. But this cycles into one other theme that I would emphasize here is that some way history also fosters a bit of gratitude in me, right? That we have problems. I want to be I'm not a Pollyanna. We have problems. Every generation has problems. But, I take a longer view of things as a historian. That's just endemic to the discipline. And okay, some things have gotten worse. Depends on your time frame and what you want to use to measure things. But there's a lot that's I think pretty good about modern life. I mean,
exactly.
Child mortality is down, right? You take the long view across centuries, right? Deaths from certain diseases, right? Have declined dramatically. Extreme poverty in the world is gone. Well, not gone. I don't mean sorry, but it's declined dramatically.
Right. I hear you. I know exactly. I mean,
it's complex. Again, it's not a Pollyannish view that life is just hunky dory for everyone. That's not what I'm saying at all. But it depends on your time frame you want to use to measure. But again, where I land on it is to say, hey, life wasn't so great in the past and all is not so terrible now or vice versa. All complex and full of ambiguity, but maybe we should appreciate something. A few years back, read Robert Gordon's book on economic history of the last century or more, big book, right? And, he sort of has this cute little thought experiment, but I think there's a profound point he's making. He said, look, I'll give you your iPhone and all the inventions of the last 15 years if you let me keep the inventions of the first, 30 years of the 20th century. And he said, look what happened, right? I get indoor plumbing. I get electricity, central heating and cooling. There's this incredible burst of technological innovation then that made life a lot better. And you know, again, if you carry your bucket to the well if you want some water today. Let's not romanticize that. You know,
right? I sometimes say to friends and students, you know, there's something to be said for the 20th and 21st centuries.
That's right, exactly. There's a lot to be said for all our problems.
And everything you said is so well. You certainly convinced me about why history matters. But you know, the other thing you touch on, which I felt for a long time, but I feel especially strongly amid the current pandemic, is that history offers, you know, it offers some sober lessons, right? But it also offers hope.
Yeah,
it's a mix. And I think the other thing you said, which I've been thinking a lot about lately, is it and this is a point Sam Weinberg makes in some of his work on historical thinking. Sam Weinberg out of Stanford, but that history can help us slow down our thinking, right, and take the long view, and maybe be skeptical of some of these pronouncements that you know, we know what the record is, as you said, predicting the future. Well, your students are lucky to have you. We were lucky to have you as a student at Gustavus. I don't know if you ever took a class with me. I don't think so. Maybe Kate or...
No, I took Kate's women's history class. You know, I regret it. I'm sorry to say. I didn't for whatever reason. No, I was lucky. I was lucky to have plenty of good professors in the history department elsewhere.
Great department and still are.
I remain deeply grateful for the education I received. Continues to be very profoundly influential.
We're proud of our alums, and my God, we have a lot of fine historians out there, and you're one of them, and hope to have you back on campus, both just for a visit, but also maybe to give a talk at some point when we can. So Tim, this has been a real pleasure. I've become even more interested in political history, and your book has really only added to that. So take good care. Thanks again. We'll see what November 2020 brings.
Yes, indeed. Thank you, Greg. It's been a pleasure to be with you.
Quite welcome. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.